Quite honestly, what I would like sanctification to be is a quick fix so that I feel better, so that my life is a whole lot easier. But that's not what sanctification is about. It's not a quick fix. It doesn't make my life easier.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
We're in the series Being a Christian, understanding key biblical concepts. Jack, we've probably done maybe three of these. Would you say about three of these?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah. So how many more do you think we're going to do?
Well, I'm not sure.
We've got quite a list here, don't we?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so what we're trying to do is really look at the key biblical concepts. Today we're going to look at sanctification. And we're trying to make them as juicy as we can as opposed to dry, trying to understand how they look in our lives. We're trying to get underneath and around these concepts so that we can understand them. And when we read the Bible, we can get what it's saying a whole lot better than just thinking we understand what it says, but really understand the meatiness of these terms.
Right. Sanctification is a tough one. I can remember as a Bible student and a young Bible teacher really stumbling on this one, having a hard time getting some kind of grasp on what the New Testament authors meant by sanctification. And my contention would be there are a lot of people out there who think they know what it means that really have not grasped what the New Testament writers mean by it.
So I think
it's worth working at and trying to understand.
So maybe we should maybe suggest that people wipe their slate clean.
I think so. Yeah, I think so. That it's not what I taught sanctification was ended up misleading me and kind of sabotaging my efforts to understand the New Testament for a number of years. I think it set me back. So I think it'd be better to wipe your slate clean and start over and let's start from scratch and see if we can understand this.
So what you're saying is that you really misunderstood it and out of your misunderstanding taught it in that way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, something I really like about what you do a lot, Jack, is you say that you made mistakes, and that's really nice because it encourages all of us to be able to say, I made a mistake, I didn't get it, maybe I was wrong. And it's a pretty big thing for you to say, I made a mistake as a Bible teacher, because that's what you do with your life. Somebody else may easily be able to say, I made a mistake with that. But, you know, I think that's, if people will look at that, a gym teacher could say, you know, I really taught calisthenics wrong. I really hurt all those students. I think it brings it home. And I know this is a little bit off the subject, but I like that about you, that you're willing to say when you're wrong, and here's one area where you were.
Well, thank you. I hope that's true. I know. I was writing a paper once, and not that long ago, at the study center, and I set out, it was going to be, well, I won't get into the technicalities of it, but I set out to write one paper in one direction, and in the course of my studies, I realized that the whole way I was thinking about this topic was completely wrong, and I had been wrong for years and years and years. And there came a point in my study, in my writing, in my deliberation about this paper, where I had to make a decision. I had to decide, are you going to admit that you've been wrong for years and years and years, and pretty significantly wrong, I think, in my view. And all of a sudden, on a dime here, turn and go a radically different direction in your thinking and your theology? Or couldn't you just use your ability with words and reasoning to just make what you used to say sound right?
Couldn't you finesse your way out of it and lie to people?
Exactly. And it really did, you know, to my to my horror and shame, it really did occur to me that maybe that's what I should do. And fortunately,
to save your own hide.
Yeah,
not
yeah,
to just, care about any of us who are listening to you, but
right,
for you.
Just so it wasn't quite so embarrassing, not quite so humiliating for me. But fortunately, partly I think by God's grace, I made the right choice, which was to just fess up and admit I've been looking at this wrong.
And that would have been hard. I think I was one of the people in the audience when you came out with that paper. It was one of those Saturday papers that, mm-hmm. that we were doing a few years back. And I remember sitting there thinking, oh my heavens, because my mouth just dropped and I thought, I have to relearn all that?
Yeah, yeah.
So you didn't probably get a lot of very positive response about people being excited that they have to kind of change their mind about something.
Yeah, it was a lot of tentativeness, like, well, what you're saying sounds sort of right, but this can't be true. Yeah, it wasn't exactly an overwhelming positive response, but it had to be done. I mean, I remember talking to a friend of mine, a guy that I'd gone to college with, and I went on to work at a church as an intern, and he went on to seminary. And then a few years later, we ended up in the same place. I don't remember why exactly, but we ended up in the same place for a summer. And we were talking, and he was commenting, I think he was even criticizing me, because what they had taught him at seminary was, if you're not really sure what a text means, go ahead and teach it with authority anyway. I mean, you just need to let the people out there know that you know what you're doing. So don't ever be tentative, because you'll undermine your own authority as a preacher and a pastor if you are tentative.
Ouch.
And I can remember just being horrified at that. This is what a seminary is teaching? Because in my mind, you know, the mark of integrity is that you are you teach as tentatively as you are seeing. I mean, if what you're seeing, you're only tentatively grasping, and you're not really sure if you're right, you're not really certain, then the really honest and open and forthright thing to do is to say, I'm really not sure what this text means. I think it might mean this, but I don't really know. Help me. You give me some ideas. You help me understand. Let's work on this together. And in my mind, that doesn't undermine a teacher's authority. It may in some people's eyes. You know, there may be some people out there who just want a pope, who just want somebody to tell them what to believe, and it doesn't really make any difference to them whether it's true. They just want somebody to give them the security of feeling like
they've got
they have
stability.
A direction. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's probably where that seminary may have been coming from, is people really are floundering out there. And maybe the seminary sees themselves as needing to be the backbone of people who are floundering. But that's really misled, because what they're doing is of course not loving people by really communicating the truth to them, which is the backbone of our life.
That's the only real anchor. Yeah.
Yeah. And we're getting an incorrect backbone. We're looking at something that's not even right, that's not going to be substantial for us. So yeah. That scares me that you say that.
Well, it scared me. It really shocked me. But I think that's a lot more prevalent than we probably realize. And there's a certain, you know, there's a certain seduction to that. I mean, oh, you mean by becoming a pastor, I can be that backbone to people's lives? I can play that role in their life? I can, in a sense, be the Messiah to them? And the idea of being the Messiah is sort of an interesting idea if you're willing to take it on. But I can't do that. I'm just too very much aware that I'm floundering, I'm stumbling, I'm groping in the dark trying to find my way to the truth. But the thing that is the anchor for me is the truth. And it seems to me that should be the anchor for all of us. And I just see our going for the truth as ultimately a communal effort. Together, we're trying to help one another see what needs to be seen. So that's why I'm not afraid ultimately to change my mind, because if the light's in the other direction, then I need to turn toward the light.
So love had to triumph pride.
Yeah, precisely.
That's it. And I think that's maybe one mark of sanctification, is that in our lives, love triumphs pride.
Yeah, it has to, ultimately, yeah.
But let me go back really quickly to what we were saying before we get on to what sanctification means. It isn't that you always teach tentatively. I very often hear you teaching with great deal of strength and a lot of commitment to what you're saying. both on the radio and at other times that I hear you teach. So it's not as though you're backpedaling all the time and just saying I might not be right. I think you're tentative when you really know you are, and you'll say that. There's other times when you're very, very straightforward, but I think what we're talking about is ultimately being tentative, being willing to be instructed by the Scripture, and if it tells you something different than you thought, then you're willing to say that and change your mind about it. It doesn't mean that you have to soft pedal the truth as you see it.
No, not at all. I think we should be very courageous and confident about what we see clearly. But you know, I have to say, there are things that I've seen clearly in the past that were wrong, and that I now know were wrong. So we can't even measure a person's confidence, a teacher's confidence. We can't even use that as a gauge for what's true. If they have integrity, they really are truly confident. But just because someone sees something or thinks they see something clearly doesn't really make it true. And we always, and my confidence today can't be a basis upon which I just refuse to change my mind in the future. I always need to go where the biblical data goes, the biblical teaching, the evidence from the Bible takes me, where reasoned interpretation of the Bible, what it demands, that's where I need to follow, regardless of what seemed clear to me in the future. I mean, I have, in the course of my lifetime, I have gone 180 degrees on two or three major doctrinal theological issues. And I was forced there just because the more I studied the Bible, the more I realized I can't keep believing what I've always thought was true in the face of this evidence that the Bible is looking at it differently than I am.
Is sanctification one of those?
Yeah, I don't know that that was not as major as some of the others, but it's a big one. Yeah, it's a very important one. In fact, this issue of sanctification was what that paper that I was talking about was all about.
I remember.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I wonder if it would be helpful for us to talk about what you used to think sanctification meant and contrast that to how you see it today. Would that be a good way to go?
Yeah, maybe we can do that, but I think to really fully understand it, we'll need to back up and lay a lot of groundwork first. But maybe just so people know where we're going, that would be a good thing to do. I came in my early years as a Bible teacher to think of sanctification as progress toward moral perfection. In a prior session, we talked about both of us having kind of grown up as Christians in a tradition that taught a victorious Christian life kind of view of the faith, where we really sought the role of the Spirit of God in our life in this lifetime as being to be there as a resource and a power available to me, that if I were to simply employ that power correctly, I could turn that power on my life and actually reform myself, or at least unleash the Spirit of God to reform me and rid me of my sinfulness, basically. And in theory, therefore, in principle, by walking in the Spirit, by walking by faith, I could in principle live a sinless life by that kind of teaching. And so my view of sanctification that went along with that was sanctification was the process whereby I learned to walk by the Spirit or walk by faith. And in the process of learning that walk of faith, I transformed myself from the evil sinner that I used to be to this godlike person that I was becoming.
I think another way to say it, I think I might have mentioned it in a previous time, was that the outcome then would be that I would be putting God more and more on the throne of my life.
Right, right, exactly. And of course, ultimately, rightly understood, I think I could still agree with that. I could still use that kind of language. We'd have to talk about what we mean by that. But in principle, I don't have any problem with that kind of language. What's become problematic for me is understanding what the implications of that are. The more Christ is on the throne, the more I just am not sinning. I am just not a sinner to that extent.
Right. What you're saying is that as Christians, we do put God on the throne of our life, but it isn't that we become kind of perfected moral characters as Christians.
Right. Yeah, exactly. That's the mistake that I formerly had been making, is seeing a connection between Jesus' lordship in my life and my moral perfection. And the term moral perfection is the crucial thing. because I had no other categories to work with other than you're either bad or you're good. And if we're becoming better in any sense at all, then we must be becoming better at the most fundamental and foundational and profound level of my being. I must be being reformed into a truly godly type person in this process called sanctification. And what I'm going to argue is that what I've come to see is we can really talk about ourselves at different levels. There's the level of that profound core level of my moral nature, which does not get reformed or changed or recreated or reborn in this world, not in this age, not in this lifetime. But what does get recreated is my subjectivity or my heart or my spirit, sometimes it's called in the New Testament, at a not quite so deep level of my being, but nevertheless a pretty deep level of my being. There is this level of my being that does get transformed and recreated and rewired in a significant way. And that is what I will argue is my sanctification.
Okay, well, before we go on, Jack, where in the Bible do you find these two levels?
Well, okay, that's a good question, because you can't go to any text that will talk about my most basic fundamental moral nature. You don't really... Only once, I think, do you have the term nature in the way that I'm using it ever used in the New Testament. And that's in one of Peter's letters where he talks about we are becoming partakers of the divine nature. And I'm not even sure he means there what I mean by that. So the Bible doesn't really, at least I can't remember any place where it really gives us a word to use for what I'm calling the moral nature. The closest thing that we get to it is Paul's term, the flesh. Well, let me backtrack. Maybe that is the word that we are given by the New Testament to describe what I'm calling the moral nature. A couple times he says, for example, what the law could not do, weak as it was through the flesh, God did, sending his own son in the likeness of sinful flesh, and in Romans 8. In Romans 7, he says, for the law is spiritual, but I am of flesh, sold into bondage to sin. And in Romans 6, he talks about, in the 19th verse of chapter 6 of Romans, he says, I am speaking in human terms because of the weakness of your flesh. I don't like that translation, but I won't get into that. But he talks about because of the weakness of your flesh. The weakness of our flesh, as Paul has in mind, is that profound brokenness at the most basic and foundational level of our being that just makes it impossible for us to ever make ourselves worthy of God. We could never perform to any standard that would commend us to God at his judgment. And so he uses the term flesh that way. But that's really the only term that the New Testament ever gives us to describe that.
So let's fill out that term a little bit. And I think last time that we recorded, we defined what the flesh was really without calling it the flesh. I think some of the terms we used is at the core of our nature, in our flesh, we are haters of God. We're evil. We're hostile to God. We're broken. We're depraved. We're perverse. And we're in self-centered rebellion to God.
Yeah, precisely.
That's what the flesh is, and that's what's at the core of our being. And I
right.
think those are terms that people can really understand.
Now, so here's what's confusing, and here's why I missed it for years. Because although that's what just defines what the flesh is for us, all those terms could also be used to describe the spirit of rebellion that you see in people as well. But here's the difference, I think. What we have to understand that it's possible for me to be a person who naturally would rebel against God, but to have a spirit that looks at its own rebelliousness and looks at its own tendency to rebel against God and repudiates it.
Okay, you use the word repudiate a lot, and I understand it now, but when you first said it, I didn't get it. What's repudiate mean?
Okay, I denounce it. I refuse to accept it as valid. I refuse to see it as in any way, I don't want it vindicated in any way. basically, to repudiate is to point my finger at it and say, this
like
thing
this.
In me I don't like, it's mm-hmm. wrong, it's inappropriate, it's horrible. I want it out of my life, I want to be rid of it. Mm-hmm. So you could have two different spirits toward this hostility toward God or this perversity that we are and that we see in us. There's two different spirits that a person could take toward that. One is a spirit of repudiating it. The other is a spirit, this could range anywhere, well, a spirit of acceptance of it. Now, the acceptance of it could range anywhere from, I'm going to close my eyes to it and pretend like it doesn't exist, to see this rebellion against God, I'm really proud of it. I think God is a jerk and I'm tougher than him, and he might smash me one day, but I'm not going to bow my knee to him. And I actually glory in my hatred of God. I glory in my hostility toward God.
I puff up in pride.
Yeah.
And it's like almost, I'm thinking about almost filling up my bike tire. It just gets bigger and bigger and bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a good thing. I want to get big. I want to say that I'm a great person. I don't want to see that I'm a sinner.
Yeah. I just heard a story on a videotape by Ravi Zacharias, who's an evangelist in this country, Indian by birth, but lives in Atlanta and is a very articulate spokesman for the Christian faith. He has a video series, and he was telling a story on this video series about talking to Malcolm Muggeridge, who told a story about having a conversation with the daughter of Joseph Stalin. I don't remember her first name, but Joseph Stalin's daughter was conveying to Malcolm Muggeridge being with Joseph Stalin, her father, on his deathbed. And on his deathbed, he just as he was dying, he's hallucinating and describing something about his hallucination. And in the very last moment of his death, he clenches his fist, raises it up to heaven, and shakes his fist at God.
Oh my.
Yeah. That's how far our hostility toward God can get taken. Most people really don't do that. Most people are not explicit and are not explicit in their hostility toward God. It's more implicit. That is, it's a passive kind of hostility rather than an active kind of hostility.
It appears more subtle.
Yeah, it appears more like apathy toward God and indifference toward God and not a glorying in my own sinfulness, but a ignoring it, refusing to see it.
And couldn't also this heart toward God that's not repudiating its evil, could it also look like somebody who just doesn't want to see their sin, who
mm-hmm.
is thinking that they're living a victorious Christian life?
Absolutely, absolutely. Right.
And they're looking good on the outside. It's like the Pharisees that Jesus talked about a lot really looked good. They went to church, they tithed, they fasted, they
studied like crazy.
Studied and taught, and they did everything that looked really good, but they never did repudiate the core of their sinful flesh. They just covered it up.
Right. Which is precisely what Jesus keeps complaining to them about, is that they just don't get it. They just don't see themselves the way they really are. You know, there's that very famous parable that he tells about the Pharisee and the tax gatherer, who both go to the temple to pray, and the Pharisee stands up and prays, you know, raising his hands to heaven and says, God, I thank you that I am not like other men, and describes these people he's not like, and trots out the good things that he's doing. You know, when I first read that parable, I was really thrown for a loop, because I thought that the problem with the Pharisee was he was this really good guy, but he didn't give God the credit. And I read that prayer carefully for the first time, and I said, whoops, what's wrong with this? He's thanking God that he's not like other men, and so on. And then it finally dawned, and in contrast, there's the tax gatherer who is slinking over in a corner, too proud to even raise his face to heaven, saying, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. And Jesus says, I tell you which one goes out of the temple justified. It's the tax gatherer, not the Pharisee. Well, why? What's wrong with the Pharisee? What's wrong with the Pharisee is, as much as he is thanking God for not being like other sinners, The problem is, he is so self-deceived that he doesn't know the truth about himself. The fact of the matter is, he is like other men. He is a sinner just like them, and he doesn't even know it. And then he has the audacity in his blindness and in his self-deception to turn to God and thank him for this thing that he believes of himself to be true that is not true at all, that he's not like other men.
And you know what, Jack? What's scary is I used to pray that same prayer.
I did too.
Really, really believing that I wasn't like other people.
Right.
That's really scary, and it is a work of God that I can bow my head and say, oh, thank you for showing me that I really am like other men.
I can remember walking down the halls of my high school, you know, being a good little Christian as I was, and literally feeling incredibly intense contempt for the people that I would see that I knew were promiscuous and drunkard and drunk and, you know, just very loose living people. And I was so proud of myself for being moral and pious and not loose living. And one of the big things that God did in my life later in life was to show me, Jack, you're made of exactly the same stuff as any one of those people that you used to hold in contempt. You are just as contemptuous as they are.
You know, I think the way that it worked out for me is I didn't as much have contempt for what other people were doing, because I was doing the same thing even as a Christian. I was one of those people I think you wouldn't have looked at in contempt because I covered it up too well. But where I felt a great deal of pride, it wasn't just my moral character, but it was because I couldn't look there, so I kind of took it a step above that, kind of an overlay, was when I was in high school, I was pretty, and I really liked that about myself. I got some attention out of that. And you know what's really interesting is when I got cancer, you know, what happened was half my nose literally got taken off, and it totally changed my appearance. And it was really a very good thing for me. This happened maybe 10 years ago, because all of a sudden, this face that I felt good about just didn't exist any longer. And so it kind of took away a layer that I needed to have taken away to be able to look underneath even more than I had yet. Hmm. That makes sense to you?
Yeah, that sounds very much like the kind of thing that God does to all of us. Takes away
our
that,
noses.
Well, whatever it is about us. In my case, it was my academic record. I mean, one of the most significant experiences I ever had was failing a midterm in college. I won't tell the whole story, but it was just a remarkable event, because God was fine with me as long as he made me successful academically and I could look to my academic success as the basis of my worth and significance as a human being, mm-hmm. as the basis upon which I accepted myself. And basically, in that event, God came along and said, Jack, I don't guarantee any grade point average from now on out. Now what are you going to do about it? Are you going to follow me or what?
Do you still want me?
You still want me. And, you know, I came within fraction of an inch of telling God to go to hell. I wasn't sure that I wanted to follow a God who wasn't going to give me what I thought was life itself to me.
So in a way, Jack, you were like Stalin at that point, mm-hmm. raising your arm against God, clenching your fist almost, and saying, you know, who's important is me, and God, you just have go your own way because I'm more important.
Yeah. Well, I probably even had my clenched fist up there, but it just withered at the last
moment.
At the last moment, and I just couldn't. In the final analysis, I remember walking into my room. I spent a whole week just kind of numb, in a daze, kind of walking around campus doing my routine as a kind of zombie, as internally I was just turning all this stuff over. What am I going to do? Am I going to follow Jesus or not? And just the pressure mounted. And finally, on the Friday of that week, after my last class, I went back to my room, and I just remember flopping on my bed, and I just started weeping. About 45 minutes later, I had weeped it all out. I sat up, and I just somehow knew, sure, I'm going to follow him anyway. And I don't even remember making the decision. You know, I can't even take credit for that. I don't even remember, you know, thinking this through and looking at the pros and cons and deciding, yeah, the wise choice is to follow Jesus. I just realized I didn't really have a choice here. I mean, I felt a lot like Peter in John 6 when he said, when Jesus asked his disciples, will you go too, after the multitudes had departed, after Jesus had said some weird things to them. The multitudes departed. He turns to the disciples and says, will you go too? Peter says, well, where will we go? You have the words of eternal life. And that's just kind of how I felt. I felt trapped. Where was I going to go? Mm-hmm. There wasn't really any choice to be made. There was one and only one way to go. And as much as I did not like the way he was treating me, I really didn't have a choice. I needed to follow him. And I don't know. That may have been the day I became a believer truly for the first time. After many, many years of considering myself a believer, that may have really been my conversion experience, because mm-hmm. I really began to grow and blossom and begin to take my faith a lot more seriously after that day.
You know, I'll share a story of mine that's similar to that, because I think these are important for people. People do go through these things, and I think they need to identify with our struggles to see that it's really, that's what the Christian life is about. We have to come to these struggles, through these struggles, to really, really make the decision about who we want to follow, ourselves, basically, or God.
Right.
Oh, I'm trying to think how many years ago, maybe 20 years ago, my husband and I had just recently gotten married, and about a year after that, he became a pastor at a church. And after we were there, it couldn't have been but a few months, things started really going downhill pretty quickly. It was really a fast downhill slide without any anchors, without any holds. And I was very, very used to being on a winning team. I was used to, as I said, being pretty, having enough money to make back up what I wanted. Things turned out pretty well for me if I tried really hard. And I was used to trying really hard. I had grown up being taught to work really hard, so I knew if I could put together some of the natural things that I had and work really hard, I could make things work. And so I saw this church thing going downhill, and man, I put my full body and soul into this. I taught the children's group. I had people over. I don't think we ever had a meal by ourselves, maybe once a week. I was working as hard and as fast and as furiously as I possibly could in every direction that I could in this church. And I just can't tell you how much energy I put into it, because I wasn't going to let it fail. But as we got going into it, maybe a year and a half down the line, or maybe even just a year, I realized that this thing was dying. That despite all my efforts, people did not like my husband. Generally, they did not like me. There was a lot of very personal things going on that were very, very hurtful to me. Both, I think, that were not fair, and probably that also were. But I remember finally, just, I was working so hard against it, and finally I remember sitting on my bed and just starting to rock. I just rocked back and forth and back and forth and just said, I can't make it work. It was this huge realization. For the first time in my life, I cannot make it work. No matter how hard I try, this thing is going to die. This thing is crashing. And just rocked and back and forth and cried and held onto my knees and crumbled up into a ball. And I think that was the time when there was this breaking of me of, do I want a God who's not going to make me successful? Who is just going to have me in this ministry where maybe what he wants most is to make my heart softer, is to make me have to look to him as God rather than to myself.
Yep.
That is, for both of us, was the process that God takes us through to really bind us to himself.
Yeah. His priorities are so different than ours. You know, his priority is to literally to break my resistance and hostility to him and confront me with the question, will I or will I not love him? Will I or will I not want to know him?
And and am I going to be the tax gatherer who sees that I'm a sinner?
Right.
And not the who was that?
The Pharisee.
The Pharisee who said, I'm not like other people. And that's the point that he wants us to get to, is seeing this core of our being, that we are like other people. At the core of our being, we are broken sinners.
Right.
And you didn't see that because you could cover it up with your grades.
Right.
And I couldn't see that because I could cover it up with all my success.
Right.
And God had to, so to speak, take that away from us and then ask us the question, are you willing to look at what's true about yourself? And if you look at what's true about yourself, are you still wanting God?
Right, precisely. That's the most important question any human being ever answers. Yeah, that's the critical watershed issue that makes the difference between the sheep and the goats, the children of God and the children of the devil. And one way or the other, God is going to see to it that my life puts me in that corner where I have to decide that and I have to answer that question for myself. And it's not like we only answer it once. As you could probably testify yourself, I had to revisit that question a number of times. I think there was once in my life that was decisive, but each time I confronted that question, once it was a little bit easier to answer it, but it still, each time God confronted me with that question, I had to answer it with more commitment, more deeply, more profoundly, make it more profoundly a part of my heart, a part of the thing that was driving me and defining who I was going to be.
And you know, God has ways of finding different parts of our heart,
right,
that I think I've really come to see my sinfulness only the next day to have it opened up to me in a whole new way. And I think that's how life is going to be. I used to think I was going to get it. I was going to see where I was a sinner everywhere, and I'd finally not have to be surprised. But that's not really true. I'll see where my fist is clenched in one area or my heels are dug in another. And I won't be surprised by it now that it's happening, but I really wish that I had finally seen all the areas of my sinfulness. It's like, so at least that chapter of my life would be done. But do you think that's part of sanctification, as God keeps on revealing
us who we are? Yeah, precisely. The more mature we become in our sanctification, the more advanced in our sanctification, the more we see, the more profoundly we see, the more clearly we see. And one of the things that we see is the depth of my own sinfulness. That's why oftentimes I think we've commented on this in the past, that as we begin to grow spiritually, we look like we are going backwards morally. And that's very alarming to a lot of Christians, because if they have been trained to expect, as they grow spiritually, to advance morally, it looks like they're falling away rather than being sanctified. But the truth is that as our eyes become open in a way that they were blind before, they become open to see our own sinfulness. It's not that we're really more sinful than we were before. It's just that now it's more apparent to me. I see it more clearly. And so it looks like I'm worse off than I was, but I've always been that bad. I just didn't see it before.
Yeah, sometimes when I'm working with people, God's uncovering layers and layers of their sinfulness. Lots of times they say to me, when is this going to stop? Because there's so much there. Some of us are just so deceived by how we've grown to look good. Like the Pharisee in the parable you were talking about, I imagine he would be one of those people who would be first see that he was a sinner, perhaps, and then have to have lots and lots of layers of his self-deception uncovered.
Yeah.
It would be really quite a journey for him.
Yeah.
So what we're saying, Jack, let's go back to what sanctification is. Sanctification is really becoming like the tax gatherer in this parable. It's recognizing that I am a sinner at the core of my being, and I'm bowing to God in recognition of that, having a contrite and broken heart to see that about myself. That's what sanctification is about.
Well, there's a lot more to sanctification than that, but that's a huge, big piece of sanctification. The important thing to see is that tax gatherer is the one who sanctified, not this mythical, fictional person that doesn't exist, but that we kind of hypothesize exists out there, who is actually becoming more and more morally perfect. That's the way I used to conceive of sanctification, is that I would become more and more perfect morally, and that was me being sanctified. But in fact, much closer to the heart of what it means to be sanctified is what that tax gatherer in that parable was. Somebody who had, whose eyes had been opened so that he could see clearly the reality of his own sinfulness and knew God enough to knew that he could expect mercy from that God and therefore had the courage and the freedom to go before God and say, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. That person is much more advanced in his sanctification than the person who's pretending to become more morally perfect, but who is not really.
You know, you just said, Jack, that this is just a side point, but that the tax gatherer was somebody who was understanding the mercy of God, and therefore he could bow his head to God and say, this is who I am, I'm a sinner.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it isn't like that, I would argue. Sometimes people just feel like they're jumping off a cliff, and they may not find love, but they don't have any other way to go.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
And that's a really scary thing, that they really think they're going to find condemnation, but they can't keep going in the direction they were. They have to go forward, and they're kind of jumping down this this dark hole, as they see it, with no holds. It's a free fall, and they don't know when they hit bottom if they're going to hit death or if they're going to hit life.
Yeah. No, I'm sure that's the case. To a certain extent, I would have described my experience that way. Oftentimes, our understanding has to catch up later. We don't really understand what we're choosing or what we're thinking or what we're doing. The choices that we're making, we're not making with full knowledge. We just know that it just somehow, by God's grace, we're making the choice. And it's only later in retrospect that we look back and go, wow, that was a good choice.
Yeah.
I see now why I could make that choice.
And the choice that I'm making, just to make it more clear, is to see more and more clearly the truth about myself.
Yeah, I think the choice oftentimes confronts different people as a different sort of choice. Sometimes it's, well, am I choosing to look at myself more clearly? Sometimes it's deciding very explicitly, do I want this reward and blessing out there in the future that God has in store for me, or don't I? Sometimes it's a choice about, do I want mercy in my universe, or do I want justice in my universe?
What you mean by that is, in somebody's life when they have been very, very hurt, say we were talking about Stalin. That's pretty long ago now, but if I was a person that was hurt by Stalin or whose family had been murdered by Stalin, would I want there to be justice, or is I willing to extend mercy even towards Stalin?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So it really depends on what situation God has got me in to force the issue of where do I want my life to go and what do I want it to be all about, that the actual choice may take on a different complexion depending upon how God is getting at me and how he's coming at me.
Well, looking at my life, Jack, I think that God's had to come at me in all those directions.
Yeah, ultimately he does, yeah. Yeah, I would say the same thing, that in different events he's raised different questions and ask me to make a choice. And I think that's probably going to be true of all of us, is that my sanctification is going to be to sort out question after question after question. Jack, how are you going to look at this? What do you want here? What are you going to do about this? What are you going to choose here? And the course of sanctification is the course of God working in my life to clarify and force me to finally commit myself. What do you want your life to be all about? How do you want to define your existence? What are you going to think about me? What are you going to think about other people? What are you going to think about yourself? What are you going to think about the creation that I made? What do you want in relationship to all those things, Jack? You have a choice to make here. You got to make a choice. And as I commit myself to the truth in every one of those areas, and more that I haven't mentioned, as I commit myself to the truth in all of those areas, I am becoming more sanctified, I would argue.
And I'm committing myself to the truth, not in a surface way, but in a way that's been very tested. It isn't as though I say, okay, going back to the mercy and justice, it isn't that I say, okay, theoretically what I want is mercy for people, and so I can see myself as a merciful, forgiving person. It really comes to when the choice is before me, and a very, very difficult choice, how I'm going to deal with it. It's not simple, like what just goes on in my head, but it's very real what happens in the walk of my daily life.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not what theory do I think I want to support as the truest theory. It's what truth am I willing to embrace as the truth through which I look at all of life and everything in life, and look at it that way, perceive it that way, and act in my life as if that were true. I'm just committed to the truth of it with every fiber of my being. That's the kind of choice we're talking about.
And it may be through a death to myself, or maybe each time it is.
Yeah.
So let's make this a little bit more clear. I think as we're talking about the walk of life, we're and not trying to say it's not theory. I think we're talking theoretically.
Okay.
So we might be losing some people. You know, I'm thinking about a big one, and back to this mercy, forgiveness, and justice. I think that happens a lot in our lives. When people hurt us, we really want justice. We really want to hurt them back. We really don't want to extend mercy toward them. To do that requires such a death of ourselves. I'm trying to come up with an example of that, and there's many, many in my life. And I'm thinking of somebody who, it occurred to me that I have been very, very angry at this person and wanted this person to hurt. And I kept throwing that out of my mind as we're talking because I don't want that anymore. And I think that the work of sanctification has happened in my life, that I really, really want mercy for this person that has deeply, deeply hurted me and continues to.
I've read recently about some parents of murder victims who have found the grace to want of the murderer who killed their own children, to want mercy for those murderers. Mm. It's miraculous. I mean, it's incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Because what they have to die to is this child that they loved with all of their parental instincts and with all of the experience of their life of affection toward them and caring for them, that the natural sinful thing to do is to think that I am so much at the center of the universe that if someone were to hurt my child, they ought to fry.
Right.
Because it's my child. I mean, never mind somebody else on the other side of the planet getting killed. Yeah, you can show mercy to the murderer of those victims, but my child's murderer better die. They better fry because it's and there's our self-centeredness. There's our that sinfulness that just comes so naturally to me.
And Jack, it almost seems like you're betraying your child that got killed.
Right.
On a very natural level, that's what occurs to us. Mm-hmm. I'd be betraying my child if I had mercy toward their murderer.
Right.
And that's how it felt to me, to this person that hurt me. I felt like I was betraying myself.
Yourself, yeah.
To have mercy toward this other person. And that's not the reality at all.
Right. But that's the perspective that we have to die to.
Yes.
In order to be able to say, you know, if God came along and blessed them instead of cursing them, you know, that really would be okay with me. If they were to repent and be restored and come to see reality, and God were to say, come and enter into eternal life, would that be okay with me? That's not an easy thing when somebody has hurt me very deeply. I want to say no, justice is what they deserve. And it is, of course, what they deserve. But will God give them mercy, or will God give them the justice they deserve? If I am like my Father who is in heaven, I will be delighted if God gives them mercy.
If I'm like my Father in the sense that He's changed my heart to want that.
Right, right.
But the core of my being does not.
Yeah, that's true.
The core of my being wants them to hurt. My heart that God's changing says, okay, I'll go for mercy.
And that's what it means to be. That's part of what it means to be sanctified.
Many spiritual leaders promise to satisfy our spiritual yearning for peace and enlightenment. Even many Christians believe that one can be a super Christian and rise above moral and physical limitations. Mackenzie Study Center staff member Larry Barber objects to these claims in his News and Views article, Real Spirituality. By looking at 1 Corinthians and Romans, Larry shows how the Apostle Paul saw spirituality.
That is, it's a process whereby the Spirit of God reveals to us the truth about God, ourselves, and the world. It is not a state of consciously feeling closer to God. It is the pursuit of righteousness in a fallen world with other fallen people like ourselves. Please call Mackenzie at 541-485-4801 for your free News and Views article, Real Spirituality.
Okay, Jack, just before the break, you were saying that sanctification is when I'm willing to extend mercy to somebody who has really hurt me. And the example you used was parents whose children have been murdered extend mercy, and real mercy, not just out of their heads, but they really want good for the murderer. They really want what's best for that person. They might want salvation for that person. Jack, that really sounds like the core of their being has been changed.
Mm-hmm.
Not just their heart.
Yeah, it does sound that. But see, what does the heart mean? When we talk about the heart of the forest, we're talking about the deep down inside core of the forest. Heart does mean the core of somebody's being. But it's absolutely crucial that we understand the difference between the core of my being in the sense of my heart and the core of my being in the sense of my moral nature, or what the Bible calls my flesh. And it comes down to this. That same person who is willing to extend mercy to the murderer of their child, what they've done is they have embraced and have been captured by a vision of what they want reality to be all about, and what they want to characterize reality. And they've been so captivated by that that they've been able to bring themselves to a point where even this murderer of their child, they say, I want mercy in my world. I want God to extend mercy to me for the sinner that I am, and I'll be delighted if he extends mercy to that murderer, even though that murderer is not worthy of it. That's the vision of reality that has so captivated me at the core, defining core of what I'm all about, that I will act on that. However, that same parent may go to the grocery store and have some poor little beggar drop a can on their bananas and lash out in a second with some kind of sarcastic, cruel, biting, unkind comment. How is it that the same person who can be captivated by the desire for mercy in their universe, that they can forgive the murder of their child, turn around and be so automatically and spontaneously cruel to someone who just made a mistake? It's because even deeper than the captivating vision of that we have grasped with our heart is this nature that just comes by self-centeredness and cruelty and unrighteousness and perversion just ever so naturally. And that's even more basic and more foundational than this core captivating vision of our being. And that is what needs to be fixed in another age and another time.
And it will.
And it will.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The Mackenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the Mackenzie staff through classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The Mackenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to Mackenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to Mackenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541 1-800-485-4801. Now on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.